human happiness. Man can only feel happiness when he enjoys good manners that conform to his thinking. And it is the responsibility of man to eradicate the roots of the traits that hamper his comfort and his happiness. There are two elements that help create harmonious thinking, and they are optimism and positive outlook towards life and others. Optimism is an essential part of social life. Without optimism, without positive outlook towards life and towards other people, towards other things, and even towards God, man continues to suffer. There is a saying from the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam that said, "Husnul dhanni rahatul qalbi wa salamatul badan." Optimism is a source of the comfort of the heart and well-being of the body. We understand from this saying of the commander of faithful that you can find, of course, in Ghurar al-Hakam, which is a collection of the sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. You can find this hadith. Of course, this hadith means that it is essential for every individual living in the society to maintain optimism and to have an optimistic attitude towards other people. Because if he wants peace of mind, if he wants comfort of the heart — heart actually means mind, it's not that piece of beating organ that pumps the blood into the veins and into the arteries. Heart actually refers to the mind. So if we want comfort of the heart or peace of the mind, if we want salamat al-badan or well-being of the body or health, we need to maintain optimism. We need to have optimism in our life. And also there is a saying from the commander of faithful Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, who says, "Ihtarisu min al-nasi bisu'i dhann." Avoid being suspicious of people around you. So you have to stay away from being suspicious, from being pessimistic towards other people. Optimism and positive expectations of those around you are guarantees of comfort. They bring peace of mind for those who live in the field and society, for those who interact with other people. Contrary to optimism are pessimism and ill thinking of others, which bring a halt to the ability of righteous thinking and which only serve to reduce the ability to move towards perfection. You know, as long as you are pessimistic, as long as you have ill thoughts and maintain ill thinking, you will hamper and you will deny yourselves the ability to think properly, and you will deny yourself the ability to move towards perfection. You cannot achieve perfection as long as you are pessimistic towards others, as long as you are suspicious of other people's conduct, of other people's behavior. Now, dear brothers and sisters, optimism can best be described as a light in darkness. With optimism, the love of kindness grows in man. He is able to trust others, to interact with other people. With optimism, he is able to have give and take relationship with other people. Optimism is actually the ability to look at the half full of the glass. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, the sixth Shia Imam, says, "أحسنوا ظنونكم بإخوانكم تغتنموا بها صفاء القلب ونقاء الطبع." You should maintain positive thinking towards your brothers in faith because it entails cleanness of the heart and nature and your body. So the more optimistic you are, the cleaner your intentions would be. The more optimistic you are, the better your life will be, and you will have a better living condition, you know. The cleanness of the heart, the cleanness of the nature, the purity of the heart and nature is the direct consequence of positive thinking and optimism. Dear brothers and sisters, let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths. different sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves, we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact, our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact, our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Optimism enables man to see a more beautiful color of life. It enables you to achieve the ability to observe all people in a new light, and the power to equally and justly judge each one of them. An optimistic person does not have sufferings. His sufferings vanish and his hopes increase because he keeps his apparent and spiritual relations with the various elements of the society in the best manners. Trust and peace of mind and happiness cannot be achieved in society without positive thinking and without positive approach and without a positive attitude, which we call optimism. So optimism is a great blessing. Optimism helps you interact with other people. Optimism helps you build trust and confidence. Optimism helps you approach other people and have give and take relationships with other people. You as a human being, you as a social being, need to build trust. You need to have the trust of other people. How can you do that? You cannot do it without creating confidence, building confidence, and having an optimistic attitude towards other people, an optimistic view towards other people. As long as there is trust, there will be peace of mind. There will be also mutual relationship. Optimism has direct influence on the happiness of the individual and on the happiness of the society. If everyone in the society begins to trust everyone else, then that society will be a happy society. But if no one trusts no one else, then there's no trust, there's no confidence, there's no peace of mind. Because you do not trust your brother does not trust you, and he does not trust other people. So at the end of the day, there will be no interaction, there will be no peace of mind, there will be no trust. Trust among the members of any society is an important factor. It is an important element. It helps achieve advancement in the society. Advancement will not be achieved without optimism. And of course, without optimism, trust cannot be, you know, built and developed. So if you want to create and build trust in the society, you need to be optimistic. You need to maintain optimism. So optimism is very important asset. And that's all for this session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share.
Welcome back. The first part of the show went to Israel's Negev desert to reveal Dimona's hidden secrets. Dimona's core reactor is made of cement-coated metal. The fuel rods are inserted into the core where nuclear fusion takes place. Now, over the years, core absorbs tremendous amounts of heat and radiation, which slowly cause a degeneration of its materials. and Dimona Accord, which was put into action back in 1963, was intended to be operational for up to 40 years, but it's exceeded the intended time frame by over a decade now. In fact, Israel is least threatened by the Dimona, having its population living in the north far from the reactor. 95% of the wind direction in Palestine is northwesterly, away from the Israeli localities, but towards Jordan and Palestine. Mordechai Benunu, the Israeli nuclear scientist and whistleblower, has long stated in interviews that Dimona's chimneys do not operate unless the wind blows in the direction of Jordan, and that Jordan should test residents in areas just across the border from the Dimona to be sure they've not already been exposed to radiation.
Israeli nuclear program is surrounded by a novel atmosphere. Arnon Milchan is a famous Hollywood producer behind films like Pretty Woman, Club of Fighters, or LA Confidential. He was also good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu. Recently, he revealed his double life. During all these years, he worked as a Mossad agent, helping Israel to buy technology needed to make nuclear weapons. Under a Hollywood producer cover, he was actually a kind of godfather of Israel's nuclear program. But there is no story like that of Mordechai Vananus. Vananu was a nuclear technician in Dimona till 1985. Before quitting, he snapped two rolls of film at the top-secret nuclear plant. The world was stunned when the Sunday Times published Vananu's story and photos, exposing for the first time the secrets of Israel's nuclear arsenal in October 1986. But Israeli intelligence found Mordechai Vananu, and they waited for the right moment to strike. Sent a woman agent to seduce Mordechai Vananu in London and convince him to travel with her to Rome. Vananu was vulnerable and afraid and fell for Mossad's honey trap. The article was published on October the 5th, 1986. Vananu had vanished. His kidnap, an illegal act on foreign soil, was kept secret. Later, when Vananu appeared for a secret court session in Jerusalem al-Quds, he found a way to reveal what had happened to him since he left London. Writing on his hand, Vananu M was hijacked in Rome. Vananu's trial was held in secret. He was found guilty of treason and espionage and sentenced to 18 years in jail, 11 of them in solitary confinement. The woman that seduced Vananu was Cheryl Bentor. After she completed her mission, she disappeared back into her secret world. Today, she lives back in Orlando, USA, with her husband and two daughters, running a real estate business. Vananu's revelations confirmed suspicions and showed a weapons program bigger and more advanced than anyone had previously thought. Mordechai Vananu was released in 2004, but he is not a free man. Israeli borders are now his prison. His passport was confiscated, and he cannot contact foreigners.
This Jewish state have 200 atomic weapons, have hydrogen bomb, atomic weapons, neutron bomb, and they are not able to say they have the bomb. They are not able to destroy anyone. They are not able to use the bomb. Instead, they arrest Vananu Mordechai.
Dimona's symbol, the only building seen from far away. a 20 meters high nuclear reactor dome. In 1986, Vanuatu took us inside. A heavy water reactor built in the 50s with France and Norway's help, with a capacity of 24 megawatts. Thanks to Vanuatu, we learned that this reactor capacity is three or possibly even five times larger than assumed. This reactor produces 40 kilograms of plutonium a year, enough to build 10 to 12 atomic bombs. Adjacent to the reactor is Institute No. 3. Here, the fuel rods powering the reactor are produced, together with lithium-6, another ingredient of the bomb. Institute No. 5. Here, the fuel rods are coated with the aluminium. Institute No. 6 is the power station of the compound. The lab is in Institute No. 8, and inside is another secret revealed by Mordecai Vanuatu. This is where Israel produces enriched uranium. Like plutonium, it's conserved as fissionable material for the bomb. The uranium is produced through gas centrifuges. Enriched uranium is also produced in Institute No. 9 using laser, a unique Israeli patent. Institute No. 10 produces the depleted uranium, an important component in the production of armor-piercing shells. Institute No. 4 handles the radiation waste prior to it being disposed. And long two-story building with no windows is Dimona's biggest secret. Institute No. 2. Beneath the two innocent-looking floors, hidden underground, are six additional floors. It was Vanuatu who showed the world what no satellite could see. Here, Israel set up a plutonium separation facility with one goal: the manufacturing of atomic bombs. In the 60s, American inspectors visited the first floor. They saw the restaurants and the offices. A special wall was constructed, hiding the elevators leading to the underground levels. Back outside, trucks bring in the processed uranium rods. Through the large doors, a crane grasps the rods and lowers them to the big workspace four floors below. The rods are dipped in nitrous acid tanks, cooked for about 30 hours, and then a system of pipes draws the water containing the uranium and plutonium. Through a chemical process, the materials are separated and then baked in an oven, producing a small 130-gram plutonium ball, 1.7 kilograms a week, 4 kilograms, and it's a bomb. Just shot by Vanuatu. The process can be viewed from level 2. A balcony was built for distinguished guests, nicknamed Golda's Balcony. And that's the control room as shot by Vanuatu. Only 150 employees are authorized to enter it. Visits are limited to the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Military Affairs, and a small group of confidants. Equipped with a hidden camera, Vanuatu walked about Institute No. 2 and took pictures of the different sections. Not only plutonium is produced here. At level No. 4, Vanuatu revealed the production of tritium, used in the production of thermonuclear bombs, which are more powerful than ordinary atomic bombs. Two other essential materials for the bomb are produced here, lithium and deuterium. All these ingredients are taken to level 5, to unit MD2, the metal department, where they are assembled into a bomb. One level down is a recreation room where Vanuatu shot what experts identified as a model of an Israeli thermonuclear bomb. 10 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Experts that analyzed Vanuatu's testimony determined that by the 80s, Israel had produced 100 to 200 atomic bombs. This ranks Israel as the sixth or even fifth nuclear power in the world. From Amman, we travel to southern Jordan. High cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirms the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. tips we received claim that in Jordan there are hundreds of cases of cancer and other diseases, all of them in the regions near the border with Israel. From Talifar to Dimona, it is about 30 kilometers, and winds or water knows no borders. In almost every house in this region, we can find the same story, diseases and death. Dimona is a word that everybody knows around here. But in Jordan, like in Israel, Dimona and its deadly consequences are a taboo. Saleh is a tour guide and an activist. For years, he is trying to uncover what is happening to the people around the Tafila region. Our next stop is in Tafila. Here, the average manifestation of cancer is higher than the other Jordanian governorates and surrounding Arab countries. We're going to visit the governor's office, where we are going to meet the mayor and the governor of the region. It's a surprise what we are going to hear. People around Tafila region are dying from cancer in high numbers. Doctors link the cases to Dimona contamination. But officially nobody can say it, not even the ones that are dying. Dana is an amazing natural treasure in Jordan, too close to Dimona. Bassem Saudi was born here, in this land, a step away from Dimona nuclear plant. He knows that his people are dying silently and wants answers that never come. Is Dimona nuclear plant poisoning its Arab neighbors? While we were filming with Bassem Saudi, some guards at the Dana Natural Reserve approach us. They want to break their silence. They also have a story to tell about how Dimona is killing their families. We are back in Palestine to visit some villages south of Al-Khalil. Very close to the Negev Desert and Dimona. Here, the cancer rates are growing in alarming numbers. The causes are not more than rumors. Nuclear radioactive leakage from Dimona and nuclear waste dumps in the area, or even both. We try to find a clear answer to these rumors in Berlin with Xanthe Hall.
200 cubic meters a year were produced in Dimona, and it's been running for more than 40 years. We can estimate about 8,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste have been, as the bottom line, have been produced. And to try and imagine what that is, it's maybe, in a picture, 50,000 standard barrels of oil would be about 8,000 cubic meters. We also don't know where they bury this waste. They say that it's not far from the reactor, and the main problem that we're looking at here is what state are these stainless steel containers in? Are they corroded? Will they be leaking? Are they seeping into the ground, into the water sources? Are we seeing pollution of the environment, and therefore of people's health? I mean, I don't know exactly the geography of the area, but there it's chalk, and I imagine that the whole area is probably also chalk, and that is not a good area to be deposing any kind of waste. And they saw that with this toxic waste dump, because there was leakages and serious health problems were discovered. So I would imagine that it would be similar in the area around Dimona, because it's not far away. And also whether it gets into the water or not, because once it gets into the water, then it transports much further into other areas and people can drink it that are quite far away. So then we're talking about basically that there would be cancers later on, or leukemia, and in particularly the children would be badly affected, because children and especially women are more susceptible to radiation. The effects on them are much greater than grown men, for instance. I would say that those are the ones that we have found, definitely in the studies that have been done around nuclear installations in Germany, that the main problem was childhood cancer. And in the areas surrounding plutonium reprocessing plants like Sellafield in the UK, the main problem was leukemia.
The radioactivity has a tremendous power that can penetrate the human gene, affecting generation after generation. Jamal is a Palestinian policeman. He was arrested after the second intifada and spent 13 years in jail. Now he is free, but living a new hell. His daughter has cancer. At the age of 9, she was diagnosed with leukemia. Nothing in the medical report says this Palestinian girl is a direct victim of Dimona. But she comes from an area that counts 70% of cancer cases among the Palestinian population. Israel is probably the 6th or even 5th nuclear power in the world. While others should open the doors of their nuclear programs for inspections, Israel is a special case, producing nuclear weapons since the 60s without any control. Meanwhile, the cancer cases and other diseases are spreading across Israel, Palestine and neighboring Arab countries. The victims die without knowing what or who is killing them.
Well, even if Dimona's deadly weapons of mass destruction are never used, still, the reactor has been silently killing masses of defenseless citizens throughout the decades, and it continues doing so. By continuing to maintain and operate the Dimona reactor, Israel is committing a crime against humanity that will be added to the atrocities that is perpetrated throughout its history. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Join us next time for another documentary right here. Until another episode of Aperture, it's goodbye.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Commander of the Faithful, Ali alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi followed the footsteps of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam when it came to applying justice and being fair, and especially to himself first before all. When we look at the life of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, we see that the world was removed from under the feet of the Prophet and spread under the feet of others. All the worldly pleasures and adornments were prohibited to him. He was an extreme abstentious person. He never ate his fill, and whatever food he ate was not very rich. He left the world in the manner as mentioned by Abu Dharr, one of his companions. The Prophet never ate two kinds of food during one day. When he ate dates, he did not eat bread. Often, it is so happened that food was not cooked in the house of the Prophet for many months consecutively. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi followed foot to that of the Prophet. He said, and 'twas said, that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi himself considered only two sheets of clothes to be sufficient for him, and also contented himself with only two loaves of bread per day. His house also resembled the house of the poor people. The instances of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi abstaining and his contentment are numerous and so well known that we don't even have the time to mention them here. It is also true that his companions like Abu Dharr al-Muqdad, Maitam al-Tamar, and Malik al-Ashtar contented themselves with dry barley bread. Amir al-Mu'mineen was as well as the member of his family ate such bread and were quite happy and content with it. They lived the life of simplicity, the life similar to those who are poor. They did not divide themselves from others because he was in power, because he has a status. It did not allow him, and he did not allow himself to be above the rest. In fact, he made himself as normal as he could be compared to the poorest person in his area, sometimes maybe even poorer. All these things are true and correct about Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayh. Therefore, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayh, he himself, when he wanted to educate people into being humble, into being respectful to others, in taking care of the need of the others, he was himself the guide. He was himself the example. Because when we look at leaders, leaders themselves, they have to lead by an example. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he sent them down to earth, he sent them for so we can follow in their footstep. When we see that the leaders and those who are in control, they live a life of extravagant, while the masses suffer from poorness and you know, less quality of everything, then how can we relate to them? How can we even begin to like them, or at least, you know, trying to make them leaders? We can't. So the leaders have to be as simple as the people themselves. Let us take a short break, then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi and how he established justice to himself before others. Those who have studied the lives of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, Amir al-Mu'mineen, and their true companions, they would see that they would have realized that in the very first instant that they were standard and bearers of revolution. and their objective were associated with that revolution. Whatever they did was for the welfare of the people, and they did it with the help of the people. In order to make a revolution successful, they adopted the method which were suited to the country or to the people of the areas and the cities they lived in. Some of those leaders and the leaders of the revolution were those who were killed, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, and the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, whom enemies could do no harm, and like, for example, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. It was not possible for the leaders of the revolution to live a life of luxury and pleasure, because the nature of the revolution did not permit them to do so. Peace of mind is a prerequisite for a life of pleasure, and such peace of mind was not enjoyed by those leaders. The second thing is that the first target of the enemies of the revolution is the leaders of the revolution themselves. Until and unless the revolution succeeds, his life remains constantly in danger, and he remains subjected to oppression and persecution. Now, how could it be possible for a man whose life is constantly in danger to enjoy the worldly bounties and pleasures? This can be possible for him only if his revolution succeeded or he abandoned the revolution, one of the two. However, it is also a fact that the leaders of the revolution were free to lead that type of life they liked and to become contented with such necessities of life as they considered it to be sufficient. Less bread, less food, less clothes. For them, that was more than enough. None could object to their selection or not selecting a particular thing for themselves. They had themselves adopted the life of being abstained and content, but had not compelled others to adopt it. Why? Beside all these things, they themselves, they wanted people to know that they are no different than them, that they are just simple people. And the Quran testifies to that fact in chapter 67, verse 15, when he talks about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alayhi. He says, he walks on the earth and eats and drinks what people has been provided to you by God. Or, walk on the earth and eat and drink what has been provided to you by God. So Allah is saying you are just a simple person. And here the people have been directed to eat and drink because life depends on these acts, obviously. This direction has been given to all people and not to a particular class. Every person is entitled to work and earn his livelihood. We leave it here, and inshallah we will continue in other episodes. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Monday, Yemen's military launched retaliatory attacks deep inside the United Arab Emirates using drones and missiles to strike strategic targets in the UAE. Yemeni forces targeted a strategic oil facility and a fire at Abu Dhabi's international airport. The Yemeni military conducts regular retaliatory attacks against targets in Saudi Arabia over its devastating war on Yemen. But attacks against the UAE, which is fighting alongside Saudi Arabia, has been rare. It's widely believed that the attacks made UAE officials realize their vulnerabilities. The attacks are the greatest damage to the reputation of the UAE because they have always portrayed themselves as a safe and secure country to do business. Yemeni officials have warned they could target more facilities in the UAE. The years-long war on Yemen has killed tens of thousands of people and pushed the country towards humanitarian catastrophe. Following the retaliatory strikes, Israel offered security and intelligence support to the United Arab Emirates. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said the regime is committed to working closely with the UAE against Yemeni forces. He also ordered the Israeli establishment to provide their counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Since joining the Saudi-led coalition in the invasion of Yemen, the UAE has focused on the southern and coastal regions of Yemen. It's also trying to take control of its strategic and resource-rich ports and islands in that region. Socotra is strategically located at the mouth of the Gulf of Aden, overlooking the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, which connects the Red Sea to both the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. The UAE is annexing the island with the help of the Israeli regime. The UAE is said to be setting up an espionage center for Israel at the Socotra airport in Yemen.
This is not the case. Israel has no business interfering in Yemen any more than Saudi Arabia or the United States do, or the UAE. But by this recent action, which is the people of Yemen simply defending their country and opposing one of the other countries that is causing significant, just extreme problems within Yemen.
Al Hilal Emirates Company is said to have signed a contract with Israel to build a spy and intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at the airport in the city of Hadibo, the center of the Socotra Island. In December of 2021, Bennett became the first leader of the Israeli regime to visit the Persian Gulf state, more than a year after the two sides agreed to establish formal relations under a U.S. brokered deal.
Israel would like to see this as a false flag, would like to convince the United States government and the people of the United States that it must attack Iran because Iran has attacked one of its allies and poses a threat to the existence of Israel. Anything that anyone says or does Israel doesn't like, it considers what it calls an existential threat to Israel.
The UAE officially inaugurated its embassy in Israel in July last year, and then Israel opened its embassy in the Emirati capital in late June. Since they signed a normalization agreement in August last year, Israel and the UAE have signed a raft of deals in various areas, ranging from tourism to aviation and financial services.
Look to the east, the current Iranian administration says that is the policy it is implementing. Tehran prioritizes expanding ties with neighboring and other regional countries. This largely forms the basis of Iran's foreign policy and its deepening ties with eastern powers like China and Russia. The Iranian president's high-profile two-day visit to Russia this week has been widely described as a turning point in relations between Tehran and Moscow. Ebrahim Raisi, who arrived in the Russian capital on Wednesday, sat down for talks with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. The two presidents' discussions lasted 3 hours. Bilateral cooperation in the fields of infrastructure, energy, banking, and trade was the main focus of the talks. Putin praised the two neighbors' close cooperation on the international stage. The two presidents tasked Russian and Iranian foreign ministers to work out a roadmap for cooperation over the next 2 decades. President Raisi said the two neighbors will soon finalize their 20-year comprehensive cooperation agreement. During their meeting on Wednesday, Putin and Raisi condemned unilateralism and stressed the need to confront it. The meeting came as both Iran and Russia are locked in disputes with the United States, which both Tehran and Moscow have condemned for unending unilateralism. Tehran has been targeted by many rounds of unilateral American sanctions, and Russia, already under American sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, is now being threatened again by Washington as tensions over Ukraine run high.
Both Russia and Iran are being subject to the same kind of pressures coming out of Washington by the Biden administration, which is trying to reassert the U.S. hegemony over world politics. They're living in the past. The past has long gone past them by, but they haven't realized it yet, and they're trying to use the power of the so-called Western alliance, which today is very much divided in many respects, to pressure countries like Russia, like Iran, like China.
In an address to Russia's lower house of parliament, Duma, on Thursday, the Iranian president said sanctions are a common form of bullying and domination. He added that fighting the sanctions requires a collective response and cooperation among independent nations. Some observers believe that American sanctions have persuaded targeted nations like Iran, Russia, and China to work together more closely. Meanwhile, Raisi also warned that the United States has forged a satanic alliance with the terrorists. He said complicated plans are afoot now to send the terrorists on a new mission to the Caucasus in Central Asia. Russia and Iran have a history of cooperation in the fight against terrorism in the region, especially in Syria. And observers believe they could act together again if necessary. The Islamic Republic seems to be very serious about its look to the East policy. Becoming a full member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in September last year is considered a major step in that direction. Also, Iran and China's 25-year strategic cooperation agreement, which the two sides began implementing a few days ago, is another major sign that Tehran wants to enhance relations and exchanges with Asian powers.
That's really where the future is. You're going to see probably a revival of what used to be the ancient Silk Road now, with China's Belt and Road Initiative, which now Iran's going to be a part of. And that may, again, put that whole region in the center of economic development to the demise or the lower position by the Europeans and the Americans.
Iran says it is open to more partnerships that benefit both sides and are based on mutual respect.
On Monday, the Yemeni army conducted retaliatory strikes on several targets in the United Arab Emirates. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the country launched 5 ballistic missiles and a large number of drones at Dubai and Abu Dhabi airports, an oil refinery in Musafa, and several other sensitive and important sites in the UAE. Local officials said 3 people were killed and 6 others injured after 3 fuel tanker trucks exploded in the storage facility of an Emirati oil firm in the Musafa area. Fires erupted in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, disrupting flights. This came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'arib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, The Yemeni army said Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. The army warned the coalition of more painful attacks if it continues its aggression against Yemen.
Just because it is possible to bully or invade a country with little resistance, such as the cases with Yemen and Saudi Arabia and the UAE, doesn't mean that it should be done, and that countries have more of a responsibility to each other and the international community than they do to their own immediate self-gain. I had the privilege of attending many protests in favor of Yemen and protests to stop the bombing and the harassment of Yemen when I was in New York City. And you can see this is a genuine movement. This is a so many people from all different walks of life are recognizing the horrors that are being committed against Yemen by Saudi Arabia, by the backed UAE, and it has to come to an end.
The Yemeni military has warned that the UAE won't withstand its future strikes. Earlier this week, Yemen said Saudi Arabia had once again seized a ship carrying much-needed fuel while en route to the country's Hodeidah port. Yemeni officials said the vessel had secured UN clearances to enter Yemen, but it was diverted to the Saudi coast of Jazan. Saudi Arabia has seized several Yemeni-bound fuel ships in recent months, despite an ongoing fuel crisis there. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel that had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The United Nations, however, called on Yemen to return the ship. It also condemned the country's recent retaliatory strikes on the UAE and called for all sides to exercise maximum restraint. It made no mention of the Saudi-led coalition's deadly strikes on Yemen.
And the United Nations has no right to demand that this UAE flagship be returned so it can go back into combat and slaughter goodness knows how many more innocent Yemeni civilians. And so I think that, I mean, Yemen should stand strong, the international community, the anti-imperialist international community should stand strong with Yemen and say absolutely not. Unless the UN is going to play fair and be neutral, and in this case be supportive of Yemen and the right to defense, then the UN has no business saying what should and should not be done in this conflict with the UAE.
Saudi Arabia and its allies have maintained a tight blockade on Yemen, where the population is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Riyadh imposed a blockade in 2015, the same year that it launched an air campaign on Yemen. Daily airstrikes have hit the country, leaving tens of thousands of Yemenis dead. The attacks have increased in recent weeks. Almost 7 years after the war started, and despite all the hardships the Arab country is enduring, the Yemeni retaliatory attacks are driving home the message that the Yemenis are not backing down until the aggression against their nation is ended.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, is in hot water, facing a growing leadership challenge. Johnson had already run the gauntlet of public anger for his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. Now, Johnson is under growing pressure from members of Parliament, some of whom Tory lawmakers, after revelations that he attended a garden party at his Downing Street residence in May 2020 in breach of his government's coronavirus lockdown rules. The scandal even worsened after it was disclosed that a party was also held in Downing Street the night before the funeral of Prince Philip last April, when mixing indoors was banned. The stories about rule-breaking get-togethers had caused deep anger, and to thousands who had lost relatives or friends to COVID-19, intense anguish and pain. The mix was potentially politically lethal for the entire Conservative Party. Johnson himself has shifted from the party's biggest asset, with a Brexit-fueled appeal separate to the Conservative brand, to its biggest liability, Not only had Johnson lost his respect, but also sticking with him risks further contaminating the party brand if the scandals continue. The UK government has launched an internal inquiry into revelations about multiple gatherings by Johnson's staff during COVID lockdowns. Johnson himself has apologized for attending what he called only a work meeting at a time when social mixing was banned. Meanwhile, the opposition, Labour, has seized the opportunity, saying Johnson broke the law, lied, and must resign. The opposition Labour Party, which has surged in the polls since the Partygate revelations began emerging last month, says Johnson is unfit for office. Sir Keir Starmer said the Prime Minister's actions and his inability to take any responsibility for them means he can no longer do his basic duties. A new poll released on Sunday showed that the Labour Party has opened up its biggest lead against the Tories since 2013 amid criticism leveled at Boris Johnson and his party over social gatherings during COVID-19 lockdowns. The poll conducted by Opinium says Johnson's personal approvals fall below the worst figures ever recorded by Theresa May. Just 22% of people approve of the job Johnson is doing as Prime Minister. Also, his party sinks to its worst vote shares since the general election, 10 points behind Labour. Also, around two-thirds of people surveyed believe Johnson and his colleagues have broken the rules and lied about it, and say Johnson should resign. That's why Boris Johnson secured a landslide election victory in 2019. But according to the poll, nearly half of Conservative voters at the 2019 election now say he should step down. The Sunday Times reported that Johnson will look to get on the front foot and save his position by making a series of populist announcements in the coming weeks, including reducing the national health system backlog, tackling the small boat crossings in the Channel, freezing the BBC license fee for 2 years, and introducing a booze ban in Downing Street. But is that enough? The latest poll shows voters across the political spectrum are angry with the revelations, and most of those who supported the Conservatives in the 2019 election are turning against them. Add to it a looming cost of living crisis, inadequate public services, a pandemic to recover from, and ongoing difficulties caused by Brexit. It's now just a question of how long will Boris Johnson survive as the Prime Minister.
In the limelight.
The Iranian president's visit to Moscow and a cordial meeting with his Russian counterpart are indicative of the importance and depth of the two countries' ties that cover various fields and are rapidly expanding. Dear listeners, in this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kayhan International staff writer. This article is published under the heading Sky is the limit to Tehran-Moscow cooperation. Stay tuned, please. The Iranian president's visit to Moscow and cordial meetings with his Russian counterpart are indicative of the importance and depth of the two countries' ties that cover various fields and are rapidly expanding. Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin both realize that the sky is the limit to the relationship between the two independent powers, which besides commercial exchanges, ought to collaborate with each other as well as with other independent countries on the regional and international scenes in order to protect the interests of the free world.